Welcome to the Observatory for Sport in Scotland's In Conversation series. For more information on the OSS work and other podcasts, please head to www.oss.scot. My name is David Ferguson and I'm the Chief Executive of the OSS, and I'm delighted that you could join us. In this session, we turn the spotlight on rugby, with the British and Irish Lions having overcome the COVID pandemic so far to go ahead with the 2021 tour to South Africa. Joining us are OSS supporters Jim Telfer, Sir Ian McGeachan and Andy Irvine, three Scots who between them have taken part in 13 different Lions tours as players, coaches and managers, dating back to 1966.
Great, let's get underway. 2021 Lions tour so far. We didn't know if it was going to go ahead. Jim, let's start with you. What have you made of the Lions tour so far?
Well, I'll be honest, David, it's rather surreal to me. It's as if the tour is in parallel with what life is the rest of the world. You know, it's in isolation. And to be quite honest, I feel remote, especially when you're watching the games, because the pitches, there's not a soul apart from the participants there, and doesn't seem to be any kind of atmosphere. So I'm not overwhelmed with enthusiasm at the moment. I'm a bit underwhelmed. And I feel that the test series may take off on Saturday, but up to now, it's been very disappointing. And some of the games have just been a farce as far as I'm concerned.
Ian, you've been closer to it. You've been on the couch there with Sky Sports, watching against part of the panel. You'll be there again on Saturday. Do you feel that's brought you into the tour then? Are you experiencing it a bit different to Jim?
No, I'd agree with Jim. I think we've talked off air about, you know, there's no atmosphere in the grounds. There's a hollowness. I'm disappointed with the quality of the opposition, but I suppose the pandemic meant that they were going to play in bubbles, which does restrict what they can do. If I'm honest, I would have preferred to see four test matches over here and crowds, because I thought the atmosphere at Murrayfield for the Japan game was excellent. And just the reaction of the people that were there all in Lions jerseys, I just think it would have consolidated what the Lions might need in the future. I worry that it's left a hollowness that nobody can do anything about. The pandemic's caused that. I just feel there was maybe an opportunity lost.
Yeah, it's interesting, the chance of having it at home. Andy, what's your take on what you've seen so far and what Ian said there?
Well, without being boring, I would tend to concur with Jim and Geach. I think it's very sad for the players, because there's no way it can be nearly as enjoyable as a conventional Lions tour, you know, to be locked up in a hotel. They're all rooming in single rooms. There's not going to be the camaraderie and the fellowship. I also think that the games have been pretty disappointing, because if we're being honest, the South African provincial teams have been nothing like at full strength. I mean, on a normal Lions tour, when you take on Transvaal and Northern Transvaal and Western Province and these sort of teams, it's a hell of a match. And frankly, they've not been. The only decent test they've had has been the Springbok B team, or A team rather. And in fairness, that was a good game. I'm not sure that the tour should have gone ahead in South Africa. I tend to agree with Ian. I think it would have been a much better tour to have been held over here. I think also the unions financially would have benefited a lot more, because I'm sure that there would have been large crowds. Having said that, I give the organisers a lot of credit for how they've managed to organise something in very, very challenging circumstances. And I also feel sorry for the players, because it's not going to be like a real Lions tour. But the lads can only play what's in front of them. And it looks to me as if they've got a great team spirit. You know, they're well organised. And to be honest, I think they've made the very best of very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And as I say, happy for people to share their questions on that and their views. If you've got views on that as well, feel free to share them with us. What would a Lions tour have looked like had it been in the UK? That's an interesting one, Geach, certainly.
I think the opportunity missed is that 300,000 people and a lot of school children could have seen the Lions firsthand. And actually, there could have been something created on the back of that that actually would have inspired youngsters in a different way. There's 35,000 go on tour, but I think they could have touched, you know, a lot more than that, actually seeing the Lions firsthand.
That's a good point, Geach. Yeah, definitely. Okay, we'll come back to the Lions this week and we'll come back to the test team. I have now seen the leaked 15. It's not due to be announced until tomorrow, so we'll straight save that for you until later. There are definitely surprises in that. There are definitely names in there that none of our panel saw. But what we're going to do is come back a little to your first taste of the Lions then, Geach. I mean, I know from speaking to you many times, and Jim and Andy, how much the Lions has meant to you and how important it's been to you. Let's go back, Jim. You go back to 1966. I think there was a sports event going on down south of the border that year, but I don't think many of us can remember it. Of more importance to you was what was going on in New Zealand. Can you take us back to that first time of becoming a Lion and going off on that tour to New Zealand?
Well, actually, it was a 35-match tour to Australia, New Zealand and Canada. So it was 8 matches in Australia, 25 in New Zealand, and 2 in Canada. And at that time in the borders, we had the border circuit of 7th. And I remember it was around the 20th of April, I went to Jade 7th. And that night, on the Saturday night, Frank Ridley got on the train at Melrose, I got on at Newtown St. Boswell's, and Derek Grant got on the train at Hoyke. We went down to London for a week. There were 3 Scots further down there. They were London Scots, you know, Henshawwood, Campbell Lamerton, and can't remember the 6th.
Stuart Wilson.
We went across Australia for 8 matches from Perth to Sydney and played 8 matches there. And we won 2 test matches. And we got to New Zealand, cock-a-hoop. Undefeated. We drew a game, but we won the test matches. And the first game was at Invercargill on a Saturday. It was a pouring day, wet day, and we got thumped. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks on the Saturday, we had to take on the provincial sides. So at the end of the tour, I came back on the 20th of September. And that, if you work it out, is 5 months away. And I had to ask permission to get off my work as a teacher at Gala Academy, and no pay. There was only 4 players of the 30 who didn't get paid, and we were all teachers. And I remember coming back and going to the director of education in Gala Shields, where it was Selkirkshire then. I said, I would like to get my holiday pay, please. And he said, you don't get holidays in teaching. You can be brought back from anywhere and work, you know, in a crisis. So the length of the tour was fantastic, if you like that sort of thing. But the tour itself was very, very hard. And you don't cross the New Zealand north, south, east, west. You in Auckland 3 or 4 times. You were in Wellington 3 or 4 times. And there was carnivals every time the team turned up. It was a huge occasion. Andy was on about bonds being created between players and the camaraderie. You can imagine that if you're living with each other for 5 months, and there were very few bad injuries, there was 1 or 2, most of the players remained on tour, then you really get to know people. And my best pal on that tour, and he remained a friend for up to now, was Delmy Thomas, who was on the tour as the only uncapped Welshman. And the rest, there was about 15 or 16 of them, and then won the Triple Crown. And they sat up at the back of the bus singing, "We are the Triple Crown Boys." And Delmy sat at the front with the Scots and the English. And so he became, one of our friends, Derek and myself and Delmy became very good friends. And he went on 2 tours after that. Delmy became in your words, David, a legend. So friendships were really important at that time. And there is a feeling if you don't win a test series, and I'll finish in a minute, we were beaten 4-0. But each test, apart from the last one, we had a chance of winning. But you tend to be looked at as failures. And that's unfortunate because there's a tremendous amount of work done by the management, and the management was far smaller then. We had a coach and a manager, and the rest were all given to us, doctors and physios. But everybody starts out with the same aim. Everybody's working for a victory in the Lions series. And, you know, it doesn't always happen. But the same amount of preparation and, you know, working for each other and helping each other off the field goes on, as it will be with the present Lions, except that sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not successful. And the All Blacks became very good after that tour, and then they were beaten in 71, but they were very good in 67 when they came to Britain. I think they were unbeaten, actually. Brian Lahore, Mids, and these players were fantastic players. But, I learned so much in New Zealand about New Zealand provincial rugby and New Zealand rugby that's where my philosophy of coaching came from. And being trod upon and run over by little farmers from Timaru, you know, had a lasting memory on me and probably a lasting in my bruising on my body as well. But it taught me a lesson of how the game in New Zealand is so simple, but so efficient. And, you know, it's easy to copy in a way, but you have to be very good and very good at the basics.
You learned a lot, as you say, from that tour. You also had the chance to captain the Lions. You're only 26 here in your first Lions tour. You had the chance. Didn't last long, your captaincy, did it?
No, well, I was picked as captain for Canterbury. And next to probably Auckland at that time and Canterbury and Wellington, the usual suspects, they were the strongest teams. And so we came to Canterbury and we won. Oh, it was a great game. I mean, 8-6 or something, you know. We managed to be ahead at the end of the fight, if you like. And afterwards, I remember Des O'Brien, the manager, a very nice chap, great sense of humour, says, "I'm going to give them a hard time here. You be gentle on them." Well, being me, I couldn't be very subtle. So my words were, and I paraphrase now, I wouldn't say that today's game was dirtier than the rest of the games, because all the games in New Zealand have been dirty. And I went on about the refereeing and so on. And you get to the stage, David, I don't know if you've ever done it, or Ian or Andy, you get to the stage that you want to stop speaking, but you can't, you know, you keep on going until Derek pulled me off the stage. And after the game, he's dead now, but one of the reporters came to me, he worked for the Wellington Post, he says, "That's exactly what should have been said." And I was pilloried, absolutely pilloried in the press, and he changed his tune. He didn't write that the next day. And there was calls for me to be sent home because I criticised the host, if you like. So I never captained the Lions again on that tour. No. But we won, and it was just a battle from the start to finish. Now, Ian and Andy know about battles in 74 and so on, but it was Christchurch and Canterbury, as they were called at that time, were the team that had the, you know, they wanted to take the Lions down. But we fought them tooth and nail, because after two or three games in New Zealand, people like Noel Murphy, Alan Pask, and some of these players, a bit like Martin Johnson and players in the recent past, would take no stick. And Willie John was there as well. And we had some really dirty games in that tour. But I was disappointed I wasn't asked to be captain again, but I captained a couple of times on the next tour. When we went back in 81, Andy was captain, and we played at Canterbury. Ken Smith was the manager. And we played well against Canterbury, probably the best I've seen Scotland play when television cameras weren't there. I think it was 24-0. And Ken Smith asked me to make the speech instead of the manager. And they were all cheering and jumping up and down. But don't worry, the All Blacks and the New Zealanders, they want to win, and they'll do, as you found out in 2005, almost anything to reach that goal.
Thanks, Jim. We'll probably gloss over then your next tour, which was this 1968, your first trip to South Africa, and the famous Wreckers and Kippers tour, where half the squad demolished most of the hotels they were in, and the rest of them were sleeping. We'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. We know you were a kipper, so we'll maybe not go too much into that. But we'll move on with, I mean, Geach and Andy, your first experience of the Lions. I mean, it couldn't really have gone much better. 1974, an unbeaten tour of South Africa, captained by Willie John McBride, 22 games, 21 wins, a draw, 3-1 test triumph. Geach, I mean, what were your thoughts on that Lions introduction?
I probably never expected to be there. But interestingly, at that time, I think I'm right in saying Andy and I were capped on the same day for Scotland, and we played every game together internationally and then Lions together in 74 as well. So we were a bit the new boys. I found it quite extraordinary, really. Obviously, I had the 71 Lions in my mind and how good they were. We met in a hotel in London. Obviously, apartheid was fairly prevalent then. But we met, and I walked through the front door of the hotel, and I still remember the first two people I saw were Willie John McBride and Gareth Edwards talking. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is the company that I'm coming into. And obviously, there's the famous Willie John, just when he got us all in a room there with Sid Miller, who Sid was a brilliant manager. And apparently, they'd done a bit of damage in 68, Jim, between them. So when we got to South Africa, the South Africans couldn't believe that the captain was Willie John McBride and the manager was his sidekick, who'd done a lot of the damage and trouble, was now manager. So there was a few trembling managers, hotel managers, every time we arrived in a new place. But, you know, before we left, Willie John just said, look, if you've any doubts about going, leave the room now. And I think there was a steely edge to everything from there on in. And thoroughly, you know, enjoyed it. We had 22 games, as you say, just 3.5 months away. Same thing, Jim, schoolmaster, no pay, 75 pence a day, communications allowance, I think it was, Andy, to buy a stamp to write home. And a couple of letters a week. And the ones that came out came to a PO box number 2178, I think the number was, in Wellington. And the letters were dumped in the team room from Big Sacks, and everything was sorted from there. So the same thing, coach and manager, doctors and physios in each place. You had to go and queue with the locals to see the physio. The doctor would come into the hotel, I think, but just a tremendous group. The biggest lesson I learned there is that the non-test players make the environment, that they were so good on that tour and so challenging. And I remember Mouse saying, or being asked, was the best pack that he played against on tour. And he said it was the Lions pack that didn't make the test team. So there was a few fights as well. But it was just a tremendous experience, because everybody was in it together, and you knew that everybody was on the same wavelength, which coming in and just being able to be part of that, you know, I really enjoyed most of all, and came back. I'd got my mortgage on hold because I couldn't afford the mortgage for 3 months. But wouldn't have missed it for the world, no.
Yeah, and there's no doubt we've heard stories. I've met some great players as well that haven't toured when they were selected because they couldn't afford to leave, and particularly some Scottish farmers. I remember the W.I.D. Elliott one, who was on a farm. Andy, when you look back, and Ian, you touched on it there about what makes a successful Lions tour. When you look back to 74, Andy, you know, I know it makes good headlines, so there was a lot of talk about 99 call, about having to face up the South Africans and take their fight to them, quite literally. How big a part was that in the tour? Was it, you know, how important was that from your point of view?
Well, I was just a young kid, really, in that tour. And, you know, I mean, I was in primary school when Willie John went in his first Lions tour. And he stood up in London and before we boarded the plane and explained that, you know, we were going to have to stand up to them, otherwise we were going to get smashed, because he had been through it all and he just swore that they would never take a step backwards. Now, if being really honest, it didn't involve us a huge amount in the backs, you know, other than JPR Williams, who would run 50 yards to join the fight. The forwards got on with it, and it was a tremendous pack of forwards. I mean, Willie John was obviously a great player and a great leader, but he would be the first to say that he had some fantastic lieutenants there, you know, world-class players, and really, really good lads as well. As far as we were concerned in the backs, I mean, to me, it was just such a privilege to play in the company of Gareth Edwards and Phil Bennett and JPR Williams and JJ Williams. I mean, it was almost surreal in some ways. And the amount of rugby that we learned and we progressed because of that, I mean, I'm sure Geach would agree. When you came back from a Lions tour that was as successful as that, you were a far, far better player for it. I have to say, I mean, it was my very first tour, so I didn't really know what to expect. And the whole thing was just a dream. I mean, I loved the training. The training was hard. We were mostly in very good weather conditions, hard pitches. All the afternoons were free. You could go and do your thing with all your pals. I mean, it was a tremendously enjoyable time, but it was also a very successful tour. And make no mistake, the rugby definitely came first. And Willie John, he was a great captain. And in fairness, Sid Miller, a tremendous coach. And, you know, the manager was a super manager as well. It was almost a dream come true. The only slight blemish was that we drew the last match. We're a bit unlucky to get a difficult refereeing decision. But overall, it was just a tremendous experience. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, definitely the most enjoyable tour I've ever been on. I was started off a starry young boy, you know, playing with all my heroes that, you know, were my heroes when I was at school, and just such a privilege to play with them.
Andy, yeah, some fantastic memories there. I'm just flicking through some of the questions that people are bringing in, and there's some great questions coming in there from different people. There's some ones that I'll come back to, but there's a question Alistair Gray asking Jim, of course, did you sail there in 1966? Did you sail to Australia?
Yeah, I swam all the way, yeah. No, we actually put I was listening to somebody a while ago about where we touched down. I can't remember where we touched down, but we must have touched down five or six different places. He had it all off in part, but I've been around the world a few times, so I've forgotten where we actually stopped. But we Perth was the first place we went to, but we'd come from Singapore and from the Middle East somewhere. I can't remember exactly. But I started off at Newtown St. Boswell's and went for a week to London. So, yeah, I think in 50-55 they sailed. Yeah. And the tour then was about 6 months, I think. I was a boy then.
Jim, your tour, believe it or not, that 66 tour is the longest tour other than the very first Lions tour. It matched the very first Lions tour has been the longest, mm-hmm. that one you were on 66. What one of the questions there from Johnny Weir, what was the awareness of the Lions like back then? both, you know, Johnny's asking about UK, but you could put that on both. Gage, do you remember, you know, particularly 60s, 70s, did it have the same following, the same interest that we see now?
No, I think the following was generally expats who were out there, and obviously quite a big community at that time in the 70s. But the greatest support we had was from the coloureds and the blacks in South Africa, who were all penned in at one end, who went berserk every time we scored. And J.J. Williams always upset the South Africans by going to in front of the Africans and raising an arm and acknowledging them. And actually, as a team, we used to end up going to that end of the ground as well. But I think generally, you know, it was people who were already there. Very few people flew out to specifically 74. There was no television in South Africa. They didn't get television until 1975. So all the Lions games were filmed. And then the film was flown back to be shown, I think, midweek, summer. The older form I remember is you know, I think it was 93. Before all the games on Allianz Tour were actually televised. So it was something a bit like I was watching Test match cricket and listening on the radio to the commentaries. And it was like an expedition in a far distant corner of the world where you were just in touch with people that you knew, which was why, you know, there's the story from 74 of Bobby Windsor stealing the manager's key to get into his room so that he could ring his wife at home without paying for the bill, because it was pretty expensive at that time. And I think he did it three or four times before the manager twigged what had happened when his bill had rocketed about 10 times what it should have been. And he sat us all in the room and he just said that... somebody's been using my phone. And of course, there wasn't a word in the room. And he said, well, I can tell you the number. I found it out. It's Newport 57341. And as quick as a flash, Bobby Windsor said, which of you bastards has been ringing my wife?
Tremendous. Yes. Oh, these, I tell you, we malign these front rows and these forwards. I tell you, it's terrible. They're all sharp. There's a question, there's one comment there from Stuart Armstrong, who's one of our, he's on our board member, and Stuart lived in South Africa in 1974, so it's not a question, more just a memory that Stuart has of after the last test, our local restaurant put on a special menu featuring stuffed springbok. A brick went through the window 10 minutes after it was posted, so yeah, they didn't obviously go down too well, some of your results out there, but in terms of, I mean, players, what you take from that, you know, we talked earlier, I mentioned earlier that you've been involved in a lot of tours as players, coaches and managers. Andy, you've been on tours as a manager, as the chair of the Lions and committee man. You know, you are involved again, Andy, 77, as you were, Geach, and then in 1980. Candy, what have you taken from those tours that you think has helped the Lions or you've learned and you've been able to put back into the Lions in later tours?
Well, just the whole experience. I mean, you learn a huge amount on a Lions tour, not just in a playing sense, but also as a tourist as well. I would have to say that the three tours I went on in 74, 77 and 80, there wasn't a great change in the tours. In 77, it was very similar to 74. In 1980, the only difference was that we had a doctor, our own doctor, for the first time. It was really in the 90s that things started to change quite dramatically. In the 70s, the coach was the focal point of the management. You know, he had a huge say, but he was on his own. You know, we didn't have a backs coach, a forwards coach, a kicking coach. That all changed quite dramatically. And to be honest, now it is just a massive setup. I mean, Geach could probably go through it in a lot more detail than I can. But I mean, the number of coaches now, the physios, the nutritionists, all the admin staff. I mean, we went to South Africa with 30 players and a manager and a coach. Now you go with almost 40 players and an entourage of about an extra 30 or 40 as well. It's just completely different. And the ironic thing is, we went with 30 players and two admin, and we played 22, 23 games. Now you only play 8 or 9 games. But obviously there's a massive difference between the professional game and the amateur game. It really is chalk and cheese, the preparation, the diet, the training. If you look at the size of the players now, on average, they're at least 2 stone a man bigger than we were, at least 2 stone, and in many cases more than that.
There's no doubt about that. It's changed. A number of things have changed, but that big change, I mean, Ian, you were an influential figure in changing the tours. You know, you had the 89 tour to Australia, where you were the coach, and obviously that the only tour still where you came back from losing the first test, Finlay Calder as captain. You then went in 93 to New Zealand, and after you came back from 93, you said things had to change. I don't imagine you quite knew then that the game was going to go professional 2 years later.
No, certainly didn't. But I think it was just having enough preparation time. I still think administrators over here don't understand the intensity of Lions rugby, particularly in New Zealand and South Africa, and the preparation that really you need to put in place. And the selection criteria as well, which, you know, in 97, Jim and I and Fran Cotton looked really hard. I just had said that you can't pick a Lions tour by committee. And that's what had happened in 93. In 89, funnily enough, I'd been appointed by Clive Rowlands before I'd coached, before I'd been head coach at Scotland, of Scotland. He rang me and just said, I like the way Scotland backs play. So he wanted that sort of rugby in Australia, he said. So it was really sort of bolt out of the blue to get involved in that. But in a way, he was good because he did give me final say on the selection of players. He gave me what he called 3 jokers. So once the team had been picked, there was one selector from each country, but I could play a joker if there was a player that I didn't feel was right, as long as I could give a reasonable answer. I only used 1 joker, by the way. In 93, everything was...
Hold on. You've got to tell us who that joker was.
Oh, no, never. 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 But in 93, it was, again, just completely different. The person, the chairman in charge, was chairman of the English, the RFU. There was a committee around the table of about 9 people picking the tour. It was voted on in some cases. I said I wanted Gavin Hastings as captain, and some of the alakadoos from the other countries were shaking their heads and so on. And I said, well, I dug my heels in, but they said, well, how do you know Gavin Hastings would accept the appointment? So they made me ring Gavin up and say, Gavin, if you were approached to be captain of the Lions, what would your answer be? And he said, Geach, he said, are you joking? He said, are we having this conversation? About? He says, you know what my answer will be. So I was shouting louder, yes, Gavin, I understand. I know you would accept, you've just told me you would accept an appointment if it came your way. I had to go sat down at the table again. And they voted, believe it or not. Anyway, Gavin got the appointment, but there was probably 6 or 7 players on that tour that I wouldn't have had first choice, certainly weren't my first choice, which is why in 97, you know, when Jim and Fran and I came together, you know, we made that call that we would have final say, that I just felt that we had to have the players that we wanted. And then if we're going to fail, we were blaming ourselves and nobody else, and then had really good conversations. And the fact that 97 was the first professional tour allowed me to go out in 96 and spend time with the All Blacks and who were there and just get a feel for the country again, which, you know, really helped me. And with the conversations Jim and I were having then on, you know, the rugby we felt we needed to have to play, which was not being played in the UK at the time, if we were going to win a test series there.
Does that go some way to explaining then, Geach, your thinking behind bringing rugby league players in? What was the thinking there that surprised a number of people?
No, I think, you know, Jim, it was part of the conversation with Fran, wasn't it? I think Fran brought it up. Scott Gibbs had been on the 93 tour and I took a bit of stick at the time because I dropped Will Carling for him in the second test. And you could see how good a player he was. And obviously he'd gone rugby league, Scott Quinnell, John Bentley, who I think Fran knew personally from England context, Alan Bateman. You know, there was a group there. And I think we, the three of us, felt that there was an air of professionalism that they could bring, particularly to training, but also they'd an innate understanding of rugby union because they'd all come from rugby union, just to try and set that off-field training standards off away from games and just, you know, and they, I mean, the attitude of the players on that tour was quite incredible. And, you know, I think Jim and I, we both talked, didn't we, about just how honest the players were and what they said. And I know some of them, I was coaching at Northampton at the time, so they were asking me what Jim was like. So I said, you'll enjoy him. I think to a man, they'd say, yes, they did, but in a slightly different way. But it was open conversations, which I think really helped us in 97 of what we were trying to do and how we would get there. But Jim, I don't know how you feel about it looking back again.
Yeah, I think Ian deserves great credit for that. Actually, he came up with a philosophy of how to play the Springboks and attempt to beat them. They haven't changed all that much now, but they were world champions at the time, so they were at the top of their game. Unfortunately, their coach had died, and so they had a new coach, Kitch Christie, who actually came from Leith. He had died, and he was an exceptionally good coach. And so they had a new young coach in. I, talking about my own sense of coming to the group, one of the great things about I found with the Lions in 97 was I'd been coach in 83 and I was the only coach, so I was doing backs. I'd never coached before and I had to ask John Rutherford and Ollie Campbell to take the backs. And you can only be in one position at a time, one place. 97 was I was given a job to do to coach the forwards, and that was my main job. I liked that. I relished that. I wanted to do it. But I was, I mean, when you think of players like Martin Johnson, Charles, Lawrence Dallaglio, Keith Wood, you know, these sort of players, Richard Hill, outstanding in their own country and former Lions, most of them, then I hadn't coached for 4 years. I had a full-time desk job, easy job at the SRU, just lounging around, you know. I had great trepidation. I was honoured and privileged to be asked to go. And Ian and I had worked a long time, not just active coaching, but on advisory coaching boards at the SRU, because we were always into coaching. Ian was into coaching when he was a player, and so was I. We were coaching teams when we were playing. So I was privileged to be asked. But I had to come to terms with the fact that I was taking some very good players who would realise if I just wasn't good enough to take them, they would, you know, they wouldn't try to undermine what I was doing, but they would have second thoughts about whether I was good enough. So I think Ian would understand that I've always tried to be as honest as possible. That's why I spoke out in 1966 at Christchurch and said the game in New Zealand was dirty, you know. And so I wanted to be honest with the forwards. So I did spend a lot of time with the forwards, getting to know them, getting the ground rules set out, which you don't change whether you're playing 15-man rugby, throwing the ball over the place, or bearing rugby, or kicking the ball in the air, or whatever. Forward play and what you do in the forwards is basically the same and will be the same on Saturday and will be the same in 20 years' time. So I had to get an understanding with them of what we're trying to do and how important it was that we were playing against a Springbok team that were world champions and were cock-a-hoop and expecting to win. So we had some honest talks, you know, and we had some, Ian mentioned fighting sometimes in the lines in 74. We had a bit of fracas with the forwards I think it was East London on the sand dunes there. These sort of things happened, not all the time, but quite often. So we had to come to an agreement that if I gave an order for them to do something, they had to abide by it. Once we agreed on a policy of what we're going to do, they would follow me and do everything I asked them to do, because I believe by that time they trusted me. And I had a little bit of history, if you think of being in two Lions tours as a player and as a manager. I wasn't coming to the job, you know, without done anything in rugby. So that's how I looked to it and took it and forward.
Yeah, Jim, I mean, it's interesting the number of players you had on there. And I find that fascinating, your story of going from not having, and you left after 1983 tour, you've told me before, in New Zealand, you wanted to walk away from coach. You didn't believe that you had the ability as a coach. You had to be persuaded by players to come back. Geach has made the point that he wasn't going to go on that tour unless you were there as his forwards coach. And you went into it quite nervous, but you came out of it, you know, with guys like Martin Johnson saying you're one of the best coaches ever worked under. In terms of looking back on those players, Johnny McGlynn has asked, which were your stars of the tour? Which players stood out for you? Ian, you go first. Which were the key men for you in that tour in 97?
You'd have to say Martin Johnson, who was, well, we made him captain because he'd got so much respect naturally from other players, although he'd never been a captain. And I think you need respect as a Lion, as a Lions captain. He had that naturally, but he took the whole thing on board in his own way. He didn't say a lot, but boy, did he understand what was needed. And if he spoke, the players listened. And so there weren't a lot of words, but they were all key. And to me, I think the game where it started to click was Western Province, Jim, third game in, I think, where we were struggling up front a bit, scrummaging-wise, but the rest of the forward play was very good. And the back play on the back of that was good. And it ended up a very good win, but knowing some of the things that needed to change. And it was in the press conference afterwards that when the press was saying, oh, we were 19 points up, whatever, with 15 minutes to go, why didn't we close the game up? And Jono just turned round to them and said, this team has to keep playing rugby for 80 minutes. And it was exactly what Jim and I wanted to hear, because we genuinely believed in the last 15 minutes of the test matches, we could win the games, because we felt they'd got the fitness, but also the discipline to actually just stay in the games and really be in a position to compete and change things in that last 15, 20 minutes of games. So when we heard that, you're thinking, that's just music from heaven, really, of your captain is saying that. And there was other things to sort out, but he set a tremendous standard. And he's a bit of an anorak as well about understanding rugby. He knows what makes things work. So he was good. In the backs, again, Scott Gibbs was outstanding. Again, just a natural leader by actions rather than words. And there was the story on the bus. I was convinced it was Jono, but Jono's convinced it was Scott Gibbs, who, when we'd won the first test and we were on the bus going to a Mexican restaurant quite late, half nine or so in the evening. I was convinced that a Jono had come up to the front of Boston and reminded the Test players that there was the next Lions team was playing on Tuesday night against Orange Free State, and every Test player had to be there on the training field half nine, ready to hold the bags, because another team had got to get ready to play. And he sat down. And the next morning, every player was on the bus. And this isn't on the Living with Lions video, because they didn't get up. They didn't get up in time. But every player was on that bus. And the Test team held the bags for the team that was playing on the Tuesday evening. And probably that team, Jim, played some of the best rugby that we played on that tour. And often it was the team, not the Saturday team, but the midweek team that played some of the best rugby, which just gave us a momentum of how it worked. And Jono says that it was Scott Gibbs who just whispered in his ear that just remind the Test players what they should be doing.
Funnily enough, about a month ago, Martin Johnson was in my house in Gower Shields here. And when he was standing up, it just reminded me how big he was. He was up visiting Doddy with Fran Cotton, who was a huge man as well. And they came in on their way down through to go to Liverpool. And it reminded me how such a big man he is physically, but he's such a... When he speaks, you listen. And he's not the great orator, if you like, but every word he says has meaning. So I would concur with Ian that Martin Johnson really was, it would be in any World 15 of any century, I would have thought, as a second row and as a hatchet man, if you like, a man that even more so than Willie John, I think, who you would look to him and think, we have a chance here. There was two things I would say about what I admired about some of the players, and Ian has touched on that. Some of the players who didn't meet the Test team, and they played at the Orange Free State at Bloemfontein, I'll forget some of the names, but Tony Underwood, players like that, Austin Healy, Neil Back, for example, wasn't in the team at that time. The second team, if you like, I was amazed how positive they were. Will Greenwood was there. Alan Bateman was there. And a back division with Stimson, Austin Healy, Tony Underwood, Will Greenwood, Alan Bateman,
Mike Catt,
and Kieran Bracken, was he not scrum half? No. They were the second team, and you can imagine how good they were. The forwards were similar. You know, Redmond had come in for Doddy, for example. He was captain, Ollie Redmond. And the atmosphere in the second team is a lasting memory for me. And one player who's now in charge of the team that's out there now in South Africa, Jason Leonard, to me, was the epitome of what a line should be, because he went out as the number one tight head. And I think Graham Rowntree was supposedly, they're English, of course, so the English press had them written up. Graham Rowntree went out as the loose head. Well, it turned out they didn't become the Test team, but Jason Leonard, I admire him greatly. He was given advice to Tom Smith, because he could play both sides, and to Paul Wallace. And he was working behind the scenes, trying his butt out to try and get them to win the matches. And I admired him greatly. I found him one of the most down-to-earth people I've ever met. But what he's done for rugby and what he did on that tour, he was captain of the first match. And if you ever hear him talk about me swearing, he was swearing far worse than me. And I admired him. And I admired the Alan Batemans, the Tony Underwoods, the Mike Catts, the Stimsons, who didn't make the Test team initially. Some of them got in later because of injuries. But they were the ones that really made the tour. And when you think of, we were beaten at Northern Transvaal, the Bulls, on the Saturday, I think it was 35-30, you know, something like that. And we were playing the Gintan Lions the following Wednesday, and we were getting badly beaten, you know. And then John Bentley and Austin Healy scored two fantastic tries. And that game changed the whole tour, because on the Saturday we went to Natal, we played at Durban. And I think next to the game at Bloemfontein, I think the game against Natal, I don't know if Ian would agree, against the Sharks, was a tremendous performance. And that was the week before the first test. But also the following Tuesday against the emerging Springboks, they were the second team, if you like, were outstanding. And that was what I take from the tour, was the amount of work behind the scenes that the second players did.
Great, Jim. And, you know, you mentioned there, you know, it's hard. I was going to ask you a bit more about the Living with Lions video, the fact that you were asked to wear microphones all the time you were there and you slipped into that, but it did make big stars of you. You know, you would never have thought at that time, you've done a lot of speeches in your time to a lot of teams, you'd never have imagined that would still be getting played now, that players would still be talking about Everest now, would you?
No, it makes a tremendous difference if you win a test match to if you play well and get beaten. And so the Living with Lions film went right into the guts of what the Lions are about and heard everything that was going on. It was the first time done. And I think that, you know, I hadn't used that speech before, but it seemed at the time, and I do prepare, or I used to prepare my speeches, as I'm sure Ian does, and he had buzzwords that he, you know, he could always go back to use. But it wasn't particularly difficult to make that speech because of what the Springboks were saying about us at the time. And being a teacher, I had things written up on the board, as Ian often did as well, so that you had a word that you could use or a prop they could use to get your point across. So, I mean, I've never used that speech before. I never used Everest. I've never used it again. In fact, I've spoken to some people and they said, oh, we use your Everest speech. I says, you're wasting your time. You'll have to make up your own words and so on. And I'm sure the folk that said that to me, they can do it. I mean, there's plenty of people who can speak very good to players and good to teams. It seems to me I'm the only one who's animated here. All the figures in front of me are frozen, so I don't know if you're hearing what I'm saying or seeing me.
Yes, I think they are. But I think it's a good time to come back, bring Andy back in again. Andy, I mean, I was going to come back to you about the move. You've been involved, you know, with SRU. You were involved with Scottish Rugby. We've got David Mackay on with us tonight as well, an OSS supporter who was there as chairman of Scottish Rugby through a really difficult time when the game went amateur to professional and you had to set in place a lot of the paths that you would follow as a really a new professional sport. When it came to the Lions, I mean, was that difficult for you? How did you enjoy being a Lions manager? And it's a question we've got from Alan for you. How did you enjoy being a Lions manager? And how did you find Warren Gatland as a coach to work with?
Well, the Lions manager now is completely different from when Geach and Jim and I were playing, because the manager in our day had a huge responsibility. He was involved in team selection, but he was also involved very much in an ambassadorial role. They had lots of speaking to do, lots of functions to go to, and he was mostly on his own. Possibly he had the coach to support him. The Lions manager's role now is really very much an ambassadorial role. You know, you don't get involved in selection, you don't get involved in coaching, it's just meeting and greeting. You're there really to support the coach and to take any pressure off him. Rather than the coach attend any functions and so forth, he should spend most of his time, if not all of his time, with the players and with the coaching staff. So it's very much an ambassadorial role. It's an enjoyable role, but if I'm being honest, you don't get involved in the nitty-gritty. You're really quite isolated from the playing side. You certainly see the players and you speak to them, but you don't get involved in coaching them. You might give a little bit of word of advice here and there, but to be honest, we're so long out of it. You know, it's 30 odd years since I played and the game has changed a huge amount. So it's really purely an admin and an ambassadorial role. And indeed now, since I was manager, they're really combining the chairman's role and the manager's role in one, and that's Jason Leonard. And he'll do a great job because he's absolutely cut out for it. He's a great guy and he's a good speaker and he's a great communicator. So, I mean, I feel sorry for him on this trip because this is going to be a very, very unusual trip. There will not be a huge amount of contact with the opposition, which is a great shame. And in fact, it's a great shame for the players as well, because although the players go out and knock lumps out of each other, they get a chance to circulate with the opposition afterwards. There's not going to be a huge amount of that on this trip.
Yeah, there's no doubt. It's going to be a very different one. But at the same time, speaking to the players that are involved, they're obviously, you know, particularly many of them who are on their first trip, and you know, you would take anything, wouldn't you, to be involved with the Lions. So let's bring it back up to the Lions we're watching this week. I did ask all three to come up with your Lions 15s, and I'll share them with everyone now. Ian, we'll go first. We'll go with yours first. Talk us through this 15 you've selected here.
I think it's a mix. I think they start at the back three. Liam Williams, I think, is great under the high ball and a natural counter-attacker, which I think we'll need against South Africa. Josh Adams has been the form winger, a finisher, scores tries. And on the other, I think the same Anthony Watson always impresses me. I think Van der Merwe's played well and been a very strong ball carrier. In the middle, I've put Chris Harris at 12 and I've put Elliot Daly at 13 because I think the Lions need some ball carriers and rugby players who can be good feet, good hands and kick in the outside channel, which I think Elliot Daly's impressed me, if I'm honest, in the games he's played so far. Halfbacks, I think Dan Biggar's playing well, playing most consistently. I did look at Owen Farrell, but to me he's just been slightly off. But I would have Owen Farrell definitely in the 23 because he's a tremendous competitor. Conor Murray, been a little bit disappointed with, but again, you know, he was test matches in 2017. I thought some of his kicking against the A team got better. And in fact, the Lions got two penalties from it, which when you're looking at a test match, if you can get points on the board early because you've got a good kicking game, that's why in the end I went for him. But Ali Price, I think, has had a tremendous tour so far. And I think he'll have a part to play. Front row, Rory Sutherland, a good scrummager, more mobile, which I think you need. Jamie George, for me, is the best line-out thrower. And I think the Lions have to get the line-out right because I think that could be a big plus for them and a slight edge over South Africa. Tad Furlong, for me, is just the outstanding tight head who is mobile as well. There's all the talk about whether Alan Wynne-Jones should be straight back in. I just wonder whether, you know, in the intensity of what the first half of a first test will be, whether he's ready for that physically. I think Itoje showed against the A team that he's a really competitive animal, and he upped his game, I thought, in that environment. Henderson, I think you need the size. And again, a clever rugby player who's been playing well. And in the back row, tough one. I'd have Watson involved in the 23, but I thought Curry just showed again just this competitive animal that he is and a slightly bigger. Tagburn, I think you've got to have a big six because you need to put South Africa under pressure in the line-out. Faletau, bit lucky, I think, but I think he's so good in the outside channels. I think you need the heavyweight up front, and he will pick and go in the tight spots, but he's also good in the wider channel. And I think the Lions have to be able to play some rugby at the right time to beat South Africa, but have the physicality up front to actually just give nothing away in the mayhem that will be the first 40 minutes of the test.
Yeah, quite a team, Ian. I think there'll certainly be a lot of those names we'll see on Saturday. Thanks for running through that. Andy, you're next up. Talk us through the Irvine 15.
Well, I'm slightly surprised that the pack is almost identical to Geach, with the exception of I had Hamish Watson and instead of Curry. Having said that, I did have Watson stroke Curry because, you know, they're both exceptional open sides. In the backs, I definitely would go with Stuart Hogg because I just think that he's the one player there that can really spark something. And I know that he's been under a little bit of pressure in his club just now, but I would definitely go with Stuart Hogg at fullback. Again, I had Watson as Geach did. I had Harris as well. Geach didn't have Henshaw, I don't think. I had Liam Williams. I've got Liam Williams on the wing. I think Geach had Liam Williams at fullback. I definitely would go with Bigger at number 10. Number 9 was a very difficult one for me. I think it's very difficult to call between Conor Murray and Ali Price. I went with Murray because of the experience. But I'm slightly surprised that it's as close as Geach is. And anyway, that was my selection.
Okay, great, Andy. Jim, the Telfer 15.
Right, well, there are a lot of similarities with the other two, and I've gone the same back three as Ian has, mainly because they're experienced players, they're playing well and they're good under the high ball. I would probably have Stuart Hogg on the bench to come on to and broken play later on in the game. I don't want to go over the same sort of stuff as the rest have gone on, but to me, Robbie Henshaw has been the outstanding number 12 in the Six Nations. And if you look at a tour and you're looking for players who have impressed from the day they came and were probably, to some people's eyes, lucky to get there, and Chris Harris is one of those. And I would play him in the position that he's played for in Scotland. He's been a revelation. I know that neither him or Henshaw kick, but Dan Bigger's a very good kicker. And Gatland has mentioned that he's using these early games to give people a chance to come through and stake a claim. And that's where I think Chris Harris has got the nod for me. It could have been Elliot Daly, but Elliot Daly is kind of hot and cold to me. Conor Murray, I think the captaincy may have affected him. He's not at the top of his game, but he's a bit long in the tooth now. But I've gone for him, but Ali Price would certainly be in the bench to bring a bit of zip to the game later on. Unlike the other two, I've gone for Wyn Jones because I think he's the best scrummaging loose head prop. In the Six Nations, he played outstandingly well. Rory Sutherland would be the other one there. And I think he's probably a bit more mobile than Wyn Jones. I would have him on the bench, as I would have Kyle Sinclair, two rugby players to come on later on. But the best two scrummagers are Wyn Jones, and Tad Furlong. I've gone for Luke Cowan-Dickie because I'm giving the chap a chance, a bit like Chris Harris. I think he's taken his chance outstandingly well. He is a great winger of broken down ball. He's like another back row forward. I put him ahead of Jamie George, who, to be quite honest to me, doesn't impress me all that much. Second row is the same as everybody else, I think. Ian Henderson, to me, is a bit like the Jeremy Davison was in the Lions in 97. Athletic, big, strong, Northern Irishman who never gives an inch. And the back row is the same as, I think, Ian's back row. I just think Don Curry has a bit more edge to him than Hamish Watson. I don't think Faletau is as good as he was before he was injured. And he's being pushed by Conan, I think. And I would have Watson on the bench. But I think another player who could be on the bench or could be in the team for Warren Gatland would be Courtney Laws, who's been very good at six and in the second row. So that's my 15. I think he'll go for conservative game, a conservative team, because he really has to win the first test.
Okay, Jim, thanks for that. A good explanation. As was mentioned right at the top of the event, there supposedly has been a 15 leaked. The players have been told, we know the players were told on Monday night, last night, what the team is. So I'll share with you now the leaked 15. This is the team that's appearing on social media tonight and appearing in different places. A few surprises perhaps for you gentlemen there. Luke Cowan-Dickey in, Jim, which you thought, and Courtney Laws in as well. Any surprises for you, Ian?
It's one of those things. It's been hard to assess players because the opposition have not been the strongest. I think give credit to the players. You could argue, as when they picked the squad, you could argue for others to be in, but you couldn't argue for those in not to be in. And I think it's with the test you're going through, all those players there. Robbie Henshaw, just worry about, Jim, because of a hamstring and just having the one game. I agree, he's been the outstanding centre from the Six Nations as well. I think with Elliot Daly in, I could see the argument for Van der Merwe being in as an extra ball carrier coming in the line. In that outside channel. Also, I can see Jack Conan's impressed me. He impressed me at the weekend. Yeah, and I thought, well, Courtney Laws doesn't surprise me being in because, as Jim said, Warren Gatland has always liked him and I think he's a bit more versatile. You know, when it's between him, I'd expect Tadhg Byrne to be on the bench because I think they have to have a big six through the 80 minutes.
Okay.
And Alan Wynne-Jones, if you're going to pick him, you have to start with him because as a leader and what he is, his strengths are in the 24 hours before kickoff and the 30 minutes after kickoff. It wouldn't have him on the bench, so he's in there as captain. Personally, I would not have had him involved in this first test and given him another week's full-on training, tough training to be part of the second test, which is always the toughest test match in a series of three.
Undoubtedly. Andy, any thoughts on what you see? Now, I have to stress, we don't know that this is definitely the test 15 for Saturday. It's been leaked potentially, but that's what they're talking about. Andy, what do you think?
Well, I'm glad you said that because I'm not absolutely convinced that this is accurate. If it is, it really surprises me because he's gone for a very attacking back division with both Stuart Hogg and Van der Merwe in it. And I would say that's very unlike Gatland. If it is the actual team, then to me, Gregor Townsend's clearly had quite a say in it with three Scots in the backs, Hogg, Van der Merwe and Price. I would tend to concur with Jim Telfer that I think it's a big risk playing Alan Wynne-Jones when he's only just arrived in the country. I would definitely have had him on the bench, and I think he would probably have been captain in the second and third tests. I think they're taking a bit of a risk with him. But what it does go to show is that, you know, we've talked, the three of us have talked about what our teams are. This team has been named as the test side. And if you look, there is a degree of commonality, but there's also quite a difference of opinion. And to me, it just shows that how wide open, you know, this tour is. Normally in a Lions tour, there's 10 or 11 that are fairly certain, two or three probables and one or two that come in as a surprise. But you could almost pick two sides here and you would regard it as test quality. So I think it just goes to show the quality of squad that is on offer. And I think if this is the side, then I'm reasonably confident that they're going to go pretty well.
Jim, would you say the same? We talked last week, Jim, and you thought the Lions had a good chance of winning this series and potentially even going 3-0. Now you've seen, if that is the first test team, do you think they're good enough to beat the Box on Saturday?
it doesn't look like a Warren Gatland team to me, I must admit. And it just shows you how poor selectors we are, because I think there's vast differences in our selections to his. So, but he's the coach and he has to live by what he does. I think this, the Lions squad nowadays is so strong, it has great strength and depth, that these players have played well. And there's arguments for them and arguments for not having them in the team. And, you know, if you take the number 8, for example, Jack Conan, he's a very good player who probably wouldn't get in the Irish team if the young fella that was injured during the season. But he's taken his chance. And with Faletau, probably not at his best, but very, very good player and experience, it just shows you that how the dice comes down on that. And I mean, the forwards, to me, look particularly strong. I, like Ian, wouldn't have gone for Alan Wynne-Jones simply because I think that Henderson, along with Mario Itoje, have been outstanding second rows. So Alan Wynne-Jones to get in there is doing very well. The backs, well, I'll let the backs coaches talk about that. But it seems a strange team to me, especially in the back division.
Final question before we finish that David Taylor asked me to ask, and it's a cracker, I think. A question for each of you. If you could pick a joker, wild card player from any generation to fly into this team for Saturday, who would you pick?
Start off Gareth with Edwards for me.
Gareth Edwards.
Gareth Edwards for me.
Oh, it would be Gareth Edwards for me as well.
Can I just tell you, I was at a dinner many years ago, and that question was asked, is who is the best player that you've ever come across? And I said, well, there are three answers. The most exciting player I've ever seen is Gerald Davis, because he could beat anyone on a sixpence. Probably the most complete player was Mike Gibson, because he could do anything. He could run, he could kick, he could tackle. But if you had to have someone that you wanted to win a match, you just wanted that one person who could pull a game out of hat, I would have to say it'd be Gareth Edwards.
Yeah, fantastic. Andy, I think that's a great summation, and it says a lot for Gareth that the three of you have all gone for that one person when you look back over so many tours. Look, folks, we could be here, there's no doubt, all night. I know when the three characters we've got, there's some tremendous stories. But we'd just like to finish off by thanking you, and I'll just hand over to our chairman, Jeff Aberdeen, just to finish with some thanks for everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. And I'd just like to echo that. Thank you so much to Ian, Jim and Andy for giving us your time. You've been so generous with it. I found it thoughtful, insightful, funny, genuine. But overall, it was just utterly fascinating. And I particularly like the competing teams there and your predictions for the team Saturday. So I'm very, very grateful on behalf of everyone at OSS for you taking out your time for this evening. A big thank you to David as well for chairing so expertly. I think he might have been a journalist in a previous life and it came through there in that discussion. But most importantly, a big thank you to you all for joining us this evening. This was a great and fun event. We have a number of different events coming up. We've got an Ashes theme event coming up. We hope you can join us for that. We've got a Ryder Cup event coming up as well. But that's not the core function of OSS. Of course, the core function is to try and affect positive change, as David mentioned earlier. I think there's a real challenge upon sport and physical activity in terms of the policy environment. I think COVID is going to make that all the more challenging. And so it's our job to try and present evidence, data, research, to try and influence those who take decisions on our behalf to do the right things and to identify the problems and identify the solutions as well. So David and I have a meeting with the Deputy First Minister coming up in a couple of weeks where we're going to try and encourage him to look at some various ways of working. But that takes research and evidence, and it needs to be funded. So if you can support us in any way, there's many ways in which you can do it. By all means, you're welcome to join us as a formal OSS supporter and help us fund research. Some of you on this call might represent an organisation that has a charitable arm to it. Please get us in touch with those people. We'll speak to anyone and everyone to try and engage more people in the work of OSS. But finally, you know, we don't have a monopoly of wisdom, so we want your ideas as well. So please don't hesitate to get in touch with David and I if you've got ideas about the things we should be raising with those policymakers as we try to affect policy change, as I say. So thank you all again for joining us this evening. It really has been a wonderful event. I think I say this every event. I always say it's the best one yet. But Ian, Jim, Andy, that really was the best one yet. I promise you on that. Have a lovely remainder of your evening. Thank you all.